Chair Miller is going to be a few minutes late, so to expedite things, we're going to go ahead and start the meeting with overview by Robin Lamont.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Some procedural things. I put together an agenda for, or a schedule for presentation. I hope it is the same as what you also received from the Judicial Department, but it does give a basic overview of what is going to be heard on what days. I'd like to do a brief overview of the Judicial Department's budget and then turn it over to the department for a more detailed presentation. What you have in front of you is a packet of material that's called Overview of the Judicial Department Budget. It is a number of pages in length. It's I think that might be right underneath your hand. First, to go through some material that actually repeats what we did in our overview in front of the full Ways and Means Committee. It's a slide presentation, and it starts with a Judicial Department sign. There's a pie chart that shows the breakdown of the programs within the Judicial Department. As this slide shows, trial court operations, which is the judges that are located in each of the 36 counties, is the largest budget area, followed by indigent defense. There are factors that are driving the Judicial Department caseload, primarily mandated caseload increases and roll-up costs. Some examples of roll-up costs are changes that the legislature approved last time in the cost of or the compensation for jurors, which doubled the amount that's necessary to pay for current service level costs in that program area. The significant issue that this committee is really going to be looking at is that the governor did a standard 2.4% reduction to all non-executive branch agencies, and as a result, the Judicial Department's budget was a $14.7 million reduction to the current service level. The co-chair, that was a combined result of the 2.4% current service level reduction and an error that was made in applying the PERS reduction. The co-chairs have agreed that the PERS reduction error will be adjusted in this budget. So the total shortfall is closer to $10 million. Other issues in this budget are that there were a number of items that were approved by the legislature or by the emergency board during the interim, which were not rolled up into the agency's current service level. So not only do they have a reduction to their current service level, but there are programs that were approved that are not currently funded. This includes family and drug courts, $3.5 million and 35.25 FTE, information technology support, $1.5 million and 10.36 FTE, Gresham Night Court, $0.4 million and 3.5 FTE, and other current service level issues, including Lane County pretrial release, interpreter certification, and furnishing and equipment. Other issues, in addition to those that the department will be raising, are issues of judicial compensation, program maintenance and expansion, including juvenile mediation, alternative dispute resolution, family law and drug courts, workload increases, including new judgeships and staffing, and other unfunded issues, including the Supreme Court building debt service. The governor's recommended budget allows for $2 million in certificates of participation to renovate the Supreme Court building. However, the governor's recommended budget does not include general fund debt service to pay for that renovation. Finally, You will be hearing a discussion on issues, other issues that are interrelated within the judicial branch. One is issues related to the public defender, which are tied to the work that was done by an interim Public Defense Services Commission. And that Public Defense Services Commission will be making a report to you on these issues, issues of salary parity, both for the public defender and for indigent defense services contractors with their counterparts, either in the Department of Justice or the district attorney, and case filings and other expense issues. I've included some case filing and workload stats, which I'm not going to walk through with you because the department, I believe, is going to spend some time talking about those issues. They will also be covering with you a variety of budget notes that resulted in interim reports and studies which were done, and they will integrate that with their budget presentation. And with that, if there aren't any questions for me, I think we can turn it over to the department.
Excellent. Carson.
Yes, we're not allowed to touch it.
It doesn't move, guys.
No,
remember from last time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ollie Carson, the Chief Justice for the Oregon Supreme Court, which position since January 1 of 1983 also makes me the Chief Administrative Head of the Oregon Judicial Department, which includes the state court system, does not include the Justice of the Peace system or a municipal judge, but does include the rest of the state court system. I'll try to be brief in my opening remarks, and then I have another piece, and I'll be here throughout the duration, assuming my health and body hold up during this period of time. I'd like to share briefly our vision of where we think the courts ought to be and hope you will join in that vision. You have a handout. Some of you may recall, it looked like a newspaper, a report that our Futures Committee published in, I think, January of 96 after a four-year study on where we thought the courts should be, where the citizens expect the courts to be in 2020. This is a more user-friendly, it's been updated, and Circuit Judge Pamela Abernathy, who is chair of our Future of the Courts Committee, normally is here, but she is out of town. But this is a handout. If there are questions on it, we can respond to it now or later. There'll be further discussion of that. If we had a theme, which we do, that we developed May 6th when we had a citizens conference in Portland for the Tri-County area and invited citizens who had had an interest in the court system. It was a joint project sponsored by the Oregon State Bar, the Oregon Judicial Department, the League of Women Voters, Oregon Portland Community College, and the local bar associations in the Tri-County area. And we brought citizens together. The minority were lawyers and judges. Most of them were taxpaying citizens who cared about the system enough to come and spend a wonderful May Day Saturday with us and talk about our issues. Strong courts build strong communities was our theme, and we have been focusing for the last few years on three things that we do in almost everything we do. I must say, what we do in the judicial branch is directed by the Oregon Constitution and by the statutes, and so we try to conform to those and do what, and budget notes are another part of what we do. Our focus has been community safety, child and family, and economic revitalization. We are not just problem adjudicators anymore. I will assert that we are problem solvers in the community. We are collaborative and work in the communities, and it's been a very fulfilling opportunity for me to see government work the way I've always thought it ought to work, and that is in collaboration in the local communities. You'll hear more about that when we talk about specific programs. But with legislative help over the years that waxes and wanes, understandably, we have been assisted, and I will assert that we are among the national leaders in a number of areas, including access to justice, which is a a handle put on the concern about the availability of the court system to all our citizens to resolve their disputes in a non-violent manner. We started out with a race and ethnic study of the issues in the court system, followed by a gender issues in the court and the Oregon State Bar, joint sponsored by the Oregon State Bar. We're now in an economic review, and primarily focused on low income and availability of legal services to those who, in two aspects, those who do not have the dollars to hire an attorney, and those, which I maintain is a growing group, of those who choose not to hire an attorney, but to represent themselves. And we are about to start a review with the Oregon State Bar on the access to the court as it relates to disability issues within the court system and within the bar. I think you're familiar, and you'll hear more about drug courts, which Oregon, Multnomah County, under Judge Harl Haas, was the second in the nation and is one of the outstanding examples of drug courts in success. We now have under Judge Baker in Multnomah County what I call DUI courts, which deal with second and third driving under the influence, and they have a 1% recidivism rate over the last 18 months, and worth that we could resolve that all our issues with those who violate the law with a 1% recidivism, we all could go home. Family courts, you'll hear about community courts, again, primarily and exclusively in Multnomah County, spearheaded, and I think, if I recall correctly, Representative Hansen, when he was on the commission in Multnomah County, was one of the leaders to get federal seed and weed money, to begin community courts, and it's working very well, and it's a pattern pretty much after the, I used to call the Manhattan Project, but that was a different program. This is Uptown Manhattan, and improved jury satisfaction levels. The self-representation centers are growing around the state to assist our citizens, as I say, who choose not to have a lawyer or cannot afford a lawyer. We're into video arraignments, both for arraignments and post-conviction uniform criminal judgment. I thought I would not live long enough to see a computerized criminal judgment. We're doing that now in Josephine County as the beta site for an automated criminal judgment, which will answer the concerns of law enforcement and corrections and district attorneys and defenders and a whole host of other people have asked for years. We're moving toward the electronic courthouse, and it'll be a while yet, but the uniform criminal judgment is a start. And of course, one of the centerpieces, along with technology in our original vision, will continue in our present vision, is appropriate dispute resolution, which is what we call, others call it alternative. We view it as a seamless mechanism for citizens to resolve their disputes all the way from neighborhood negotiation all the, up to a jury trial at the other end. I'll conclude my remarks by, I was once reminded when I was at a Supreme Court conference with our court, and one of my colleagues asked to what about this program, and I said there's no money for this program. And another member of our court who had served on Ways and Means a number of years said, "You're not correct, Carson. You have plenty of money. It's just a question of priorities." And so, to you, I suggest it's not so much a question of money. Money is a problem, revenues, but it's really a question of priorities. And I'll conclude with that and respond to questions, Mr. Chair, or members, if you have any, or turn it over.
Senator Trill.
That sounds good, Wally, but money helps us figure out how we handle priorities, and there's not enough money to go around, so all of those priorities come up against each other, and it's really pretty hard to make the decision. We need to try to put as much money into this budget as we can, or we can't do things for folks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, I think I figured out was during the last 24 years that you and I have had an opportunity to work together on and off. You've been a strong supporter of the court.
Certainly have.
And I understand what you're saying, and I don't demean the stress that you find yourselves in with the sagging revenues, $113 million short, and then you have the May 15th coming up. The only point I want to make is that I hope after this week plus period of time, I know from personal experience, and I suspect most of the members of the committee likewise are informed, there are those, not necessarily in the legislature, that believe that we are kind of like the Thomason ad, we wear a black dress, we have a gavel, and issues come to us, and we say guilty, not guilty, guilty, or I guess it's granting credit, if I remember the ad. Only the dog didn't qualify, I think, if I remember the ad, and maybe did under that program. The legislature has moved, and I think correctly, we've built our budget over the years on input, output, talking about case files. With the help of Ms. Lamont and Mike Stinson and our wonderful staff we have here, we're moving, because the legislature correctly wants us to, from inputs to outcomes. And what we want to stress to you is that we have a great impact upon, we're not only are we in the way when you hire new state police or police officers, you don't get from Superintendent Reichert to Director Cook without going through the court system. To the extent that we are omitted from that program, both the law enforcement and the correction ends will not be fed. I know you know that.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I want to do everything we can to have the best court system we possibly can. It takes money, and there are lots of other things in the budget that we need money for too. So I just all I'm quarreling about is just that it's not money, because we don't have enough. We don't, to do what we need to do for this state.
The admonition is well.
That's the only thing I'm quarreling about.
And I'll back off. Thank you, Senator. I usually did for that.
We all have.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator. And the Chief Justice gets to talk to you about lightness in the future, and then I'm supposed to walk you through the overview handout, so you can tell how water flows.
Who divided up the workload?
And then Susan Klosterman is our Chief Financial Officer, and she's here to answer the really detailed questions on the budget aspects. But before I go briefly through our presentation handout, I did want to go back to the one item that Legislative Fiscal mentioned about our presentation plan, and I was just going to talk very briefly about it, so as we go through our overview and you have a chance to think about it, if there are things that you'll want more information on or don't see highlighted as a general topic area, then we can kind of build it into our next several days. As it says, today was reserved to provide the overview on a very macro level. We'll provide a lot more detail and statistics as we walk through various issues. We'll also, in hopefully just about half an hour, talk about the appellate courts. It's going to be a focus on the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Tax Court, and how their workload's looking, and a couple of policy packages that relate to staff attorneys. For them. There are other parts of the appellate court and administration budget, but we'll be dealing with those later on in the agenda on another day when we talk about just general staff and workload issues and infrastructure. But while we had the judges of the court here, I want to make sure we covered the clerk issues, since those go to their judicial resource use. Tomorrow we were going to talk about judicial resources in general, the number of looking at the workload and the stats, also judicial compensation, retirement issues that go around judges, and then the new judgeships. We'll have Chair Vernon Gleaves up from the Trial Court Resource Committee and have a discussion about a major part of our budget requests in that area. And Thursday, we were going to look at our technology and the revenue and collections and the access issues that go with one of our primary functions is being available to the public and to all people. Friday, you haven't been meeting, and then Monday we'll be looking at what I call the trial court program service delivery, the major features with community justice. This is the family and drug court and dispute resolution. We'll also look at the juvenile court issues. We have the Adoption and Safe Families Act and various issues that surround that and the Citizen Review Board program. We'll also then, if we have time that day, look at our general workload support needs. Then we were going to look at our indigent defense program delivery system on the following day. And then next Wednesday, wrap up with any leftover issues that we didn't get to and talk generally before you go into work session. So we said that was our kind of recommendation to walk you through our major program areas and major budget policy issues for this biennium, and we're happy to accommodate any other issues. We did provide a document that went through the major issues listed in the outline for budget presentations. It's a vanilla covered handout you should have. My understanding is that I should just highlight what's in there and not read it to you. So the first page is the mission and goals, which really are from our futures document, our vision document. When you're trying to put the judicial branch into a term of goals and missions, everybody says, well, isn't it just about justice? Well, we've tried to verbalize what is in that concept of justice as we see it, in especially in Oregon. So those, like I said, those are from our mission statement. Then page two provides, as Chief, the constitutional and statutory authority, just very generically for, really for the organizational parts of the judicial branch. As the Chief said, the job of the judicial branch is really to carry out the constitutional and statutory provisions as well as other sorts of cases that come before it. So it's, without listing the entire ORS, it's just hits on the organizational. Page three is when we're talking about the judicial department. In the Constitution, it calls the judicial branch of government the judicial department, just as it calls the executive branch the executive department. But within that judicial branch, there are some discrete entities. The Council on Court Procedures and the Commission of Judicial Fitness are in the judicial branch, but they're not supervised or under the Chief Justice's direct authority. He makes appointments but not controls them. The State Public Defender, as was mentioned, is also within the judicial branch, but it's not in the direct authority of the Chief Justice. What is what we call the state-funded court system that was created in 1983 by the 1981 legislature, which really state-funded and consolidated the trial court and appellate court levels. It has the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Tax Court, and then the Circuit Courts. There were district courts until January 15th of 1998 when the trial level of the state court system was merged into a single trial court. So one thing I wanted to point out was what is not in the state court system or part of this budget that we're talking about today will be municipal courts, justice courts, and a few of the county courts. Those are still locally funded, and while there are some jurisdictional issues in common and some relationships, we do not oversee them, and they affect a number of issues as we go through. So there are 161 judges at the trial court level. On pages 4 and 5, it breaks out a little bit more, the organizational chart. 5 shows our 26 judicial districts. In our budget document, we give who's the presiding judge, who's the trial court administrator, their location, address, contact numbers, but this just shows you on a map how the districts cover. They are on county lines. However, several districts, judicial districts, have more than one county in them. And these, the presiding judge in each of those judicial districts is appointed for a 2-year term by the Chief Justice, and that's pursuant to the statutes. And they are responsible at the local level for overseeing with their trial court administrator the provision of services and overseeing their local budget, but they run up through the Chief Justice on the overall administrative oversight. Though, as he is quick to point out, they're all independently elected officials.
No, they're quick to point out.
They're quick to point out, yes. So administration can be somewhat akin to either herding cats or, you said, putting puppies in, trying to keep puppies in wheelbarrows or yeah. Something. So. But we work in a very collegial way with our our local courts. It's kind of a top-down, bottom-up sort of thing. A lot of grassroots opportunities for courts to look at different ways of making the program fit their local jurisdiction. We're ultimately responsible to the legislature for all the expenditures and for the overall effectiveness, but it's a two-way street that we try to work out as we go through our budget and resource issues. And that'll come up in a couple of other times as we go through. It's very much a decentralized sort of operation. At the local level, the courts are part of their communities, yet we run centrally up for a number of the support functions to the state level. We go through the budget organization. We have three basic appropriations that are provided. One is for operations, and that covers appellate courts administration and the circuit courts. We have a second appropriation that's called mandated payments. That covers like jurors and ADA and interpreters. And then we have a third appropriation, which is the indigent defense appropriation, which provides counsel and related services to persons who are constitutionally or statutory mandated to have appointed counsel and yet can't afford to retain their own. So the next several pages, 6, 7, and 8, talk about those three funds. On page 9 is our right, the sheet you'll go back to a number of times, which is our legislatively approved our lab budget for 9901, and then our current service level. On this particular chart, the $5 million is shown in that number, the $411 million, as Legislative Fiscal mentioned. It was an error in the calculation, and it's being restored to our number. So then we are left just with the 2.4% cut and then the other issues having to do with the Chief Justice's operating level. I think you went through with Legislative Fiscal in her handout of how our programs break out percentage-wise with expenditures. We have a chart on page 11 that have to do with the revenues. We're going to spend, like I said, Thursday, about half an hour just talking about revenues and collection issues and how the courts fit in. Right now, in any one biennium, we're now collecting about 76% of what our overall operational cost is, just for a comparison level. That's just counting what came in that biennium and what was collected that biennium, not necessarily against the aging of accounts, which is part of some programs we'll talk to you about. Page 12 shows that relationship at the top of court revenues and the cost of judicial operations. That does not include judicial operations, indigent defense. It's just including the courts against, because that's where the filing fees come in. We go through our major revenue sources. We are over 97% general funded, which is part of I guess a major challenge to us in not just this session, but in past sessions. All the revenues that we do collect in filing fees go into the general fund. So hopefully you look at our efforts in that area, but they are not directly linked, nor would we recommend that they be directly linked, because we do not want to be in situation where a judge is deciding how to act in a case based on a collection. Major budgetary issues are displayed on 14 and 15 and 16. Legislative Fiscal walked you through those pretty well. I think you're also familiar with the Chief's one-page budget document that we met with legislators in the last few weeks about. Basically, for the Chief Justice's budget, we're coming in, it says 14.7 below current service level. That's true in the governor's number. If the $5 million per PERS errors restored. As legislative fiscal said, we'll be then dealing with just a little under $10 million.
Senator Drill.
Have you looked at your revenues from the courts from the standpoint of how they compare with what other states have in fee revenues and whatever else brings in those revenues? Are we about the same level other states manage or not?
Chair Hansen, Senator Trow. I'll ask Susan Klosterman if she has information. I always thought we were in pretty good shape, but
Senator Trow, Susan Klosterman, Finance Director with the Judicial Department. That isn't something that we have looked at. I'm new to the court system. I've been there since the summer, but I have already started talking with some of the other fiscal people in other courts, and that's certainly something we could talk about. It's my understanding that most states aren't organized, structured the same way as we are in Oregon with the state court system, so there might be some issues trying to make those comparisons, but it's certainly a discussion we should have.
Thank you.
On page 14, the next major area of concern is to maintain what we call the Chief Justice's current service level, which are the limited duration positions and programs that were either put in place by the legislature or through the emergency board actions over this past biennium. So we'll be getting into these various budget issues as we go along in the upcoming days, because our agenda pretty well follows those topical issues. On pages 17 and 18 and 19, those budget issues are really portrayed in the numbers with the figures of the budget figures we'll be talking about. This is follows that one-page Chief Justice's budget that you've seen before as far as what our priorities are. The first, to retain the Chief Justice's current operating level, because as you're aware, the limited duration positions and programs are not part of a CSL roll-up for this biennium. And so for us to hopefully convince you that it's not a good idea to have us lose ground, we'll be presenting squarely on what those programs are doing and how we feel that not only is a benefit to the local community but to the state, and that it is a cost saving for the system, even if you're putting the money here in the court. On page 20, we just have a one-pager that lists budget-related policy legislation. Because judicial salaries and new judgeships, changes and retirement require statutory changes, we do have vehicles for that should be coming down to Ways and Means. I would certainly hope before the end of session. But those are the vehicles that embody the statutory changes. They're also listed there as Public Defense Services Commission that legislative fiscal referenced, and when we get to indigent defense, the day on indigent defense, we'll talk about those in more detail. There are two bills, one that extends the sunset, which was kind of a placeholder that the Judicial Department put in while the Public Defense Services Commission was working on a permanent status commission bill, and that's Senate Bill 145. Then we also, when we talk about collections in a couple of days, have a policy package that relates to the collection of delinquent accounts and how to provide some resources to the courts to improve the overall status of debt collection. And I think that is a win-win cost-wise in the end, depending on how you look at funding that. The chief, starting on page 21, our strategic plan really starts with the vision of what we see, and through our focus groups and working with the citizens conferences, see as a major role of the courts and how, in a perfect world or even in an imperfect one, we would like to envision ourselves and have the public perceive us. On page 22 through 23, lay out the major areas that are in the Justice 2020 vision. As Chief mentioned, it was started in the early 90s with the thought that if you don't know where you're going, you'll never get there, and seeing the courts be buffeted by the kind of great challenges that were going on in society, and looking at what futurists were saying was happening to society and to the courts and government if just those trends continued, it seemed both appropriate and necessary to have a visioning process for the courts and say, okay, what are our goals and what strategies get us there, and then work in partnership with the legislature and with public and others to realize that.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's really a good idea, Kingsley. I think you need to do that. I think in part our problem at this legislative session has to do with a perception somehow or other that that if we're going to invest in the future, we've got to have the resources to do that, and the court system needs investments in it for the future if it's going to be a good court system. And increasingly, we have more need for it than ever. But somehow or other, I don't think the public realizes that, and it's true of other things as well. And so, I like the idea that you're going to be talking about what it is we need to have a good court system, and talk out there so that the public understands that. They say, you know, it's our money, give it back to us in tax relief, but some of the best money they spend is on things like the court system.
Mayor Hansen, Senator Trudeau. Thank you. And I think it's a combination of an investment in the court, but that having a vision also is a mindset. I mean, it lets you think of opportunities and recognize, and as you see when we get to some of the budget notes, retooling your priorities and your expenditures around that too. But it does require at certain levels a definite investment in that vision. These two pages are the product of a work group working with focus groups and citizen conferences, and taking what many of you who've been in the past sessions have seen was the original vision, which was a multi-page newspaper-sized thing that was very fascinating and provocative, but hard to get your hands around what were the threads and major themes. This portrayed on these two pages is that distilled to five basic goal areas and updated, as the Chief likes to mention. We thought we were really hot shots in 92 and 93 and had the vision planned out to 2020. We didn't even have the internet in our vision. So given the way time and technology and things are accelerating, I think we'll probably be revisiting the vision every 5 years and trying to keep it refreshed. As you see, the five major goals are, one, we think in doing our job that access court services is one of the major components of justice, not just what happens when you get there, but can you even get there? So a number of our strategies and some of our policy packages are around trying to remove barriers and make access, whether it's through technology or through pro se help centers or through interpreters or other ways.
Sure. Just sort of a caution, and maybe this is just my bias, but I hope that we don't make the court system using technology so impersonal that somehow or other the people involved never see human beings, other human beings, and interact with other human beings as they do this.
And that might be the Wells Fargo factor.
Right.
I was going to say, if they get through the voicemail system, we'll see anybody. That is an important, Chair Hansen, Senator, important ingredient in our vision for technology, that it should be there as a tool and to support, not supplant or be a replacement, because it's a very big challenge. Because the more you open up access, the more you open up the volume too, and the expectations, and sometimes it's easier to take care of with technology.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I add on to it. One of the things that under Kingsley's supervision we've been working on is for all our employees a consumer relations program. And it's not modeled on Les Schwab, but because we don't get commissions, but the idea is to empower our, particularly our counter people, to greet the public appropriately, have response to them, be respectful. And it's a wonderful program. It gets rave reviews, and over a period of time, we hope to strengthen our ability to deal with the citizens rather than do it electronically and weaken it. So I'm very happy about the program. And it also works internally, because you learn skills how to deal with fellow employees, and it's a much approved and liked program.
Hopefully it's good for repeat business.
It's always
we have a lot of repeat business, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
More than they need.
More than we need.
Chair Hansen and Senator Troe, and within that is our next two goals, which is to make courts work for people and to help people choose the best way to resolve their disputes in partnership with making the courts more accessible and trying to ensure that people have access to justice services. It's also making sure that there are ways for them to resolve their dispute at the lowest possible appropriate level, even to the effect of not even having to come in to file a case. And so a number of our strategies and partnerships are even pre-filing. We want to work with the Community Dispute Resolution Commissions and others to try, and the schools, you know, to work with having people learn how to resolve their own disputes. And then if they do come to court or through the court's auspices, still having those alternatives available. So the trial and the jury trial will always be there, and sometimes it may be the only appropriate mechanism, but we should make sure that there are other ways that people can choose that are either less expensive or more satisfying ultimately for their particular issue. Our fourth goal is building the strong partnerships with the local communities. As I mentioned, even though we're a state-funded system, your local court is very much a part of your community, and particularly in the last 5 and 6 years, I think there's been a fundamental change in the way courts have viewed their business. As Chief said, it's not just sitting there banging down the gavel and recycling through the same people. The judges and the courts and the communities really want to make a difference in those lives that are coming before them, and particularly in the children and family areas, as you'll hear in some upcoming days. It's half efficiency, and it's and hopefully more than half effectiveness. We can take 100 cases with the same 20 families, put them before a judge, and deal with them as a whole, all their issues, which I think is a more efficient way for the courts to process their cases. Hopefully in doing that and having the court have the hammer for a single plan and approach working with the family and the service providers, it'll also be a more effective resolution of the issues. We do have some data we'll be presenting on some families that have been in the system for some of our repeat customers a longer time, and hopefully you have an opportunity to see that there's less judicial action over time and maybe less serious action with the children of those families and on. That our final goal is really a summary of a part of not only being a court system but state government, which is to earn our public's trust and confidence in the systems, especially with the court system being the major institution and backbone of a democratic society. We really want to have people look to the court system as that authority and that appropriate command over order in society, so that we are not dissolve into a chaotic system. Performance measures, those start in 24, and those are a lot harder also in a court system, as you can imagine. How do you measure justice? Having said that, we are finding ways to not necessarily measure justice as, but in trying to define maybe what justice is in particular types of cases, what would measure those outcomes. The first several pages are some performance measures that deal with outcomes for measuring the vision. These three were done on pages 24 through 26 preceded the final version of the vision that we just walked through, so we are going back now over the next few months and what I would say aligning these goals with that latest vision, and then we will have a little bit later a final measure in that area of how are we going in relation to the vision. We do have some other ones that have been in place. One new one was the integrated family and drug court outcomes. You'll hear about that on the day we talk about family and drug court, but basically through budget notes we were to come up with measures of how to see if the investment in drug courts and family courts were a productive investment. And so we do have outcome measures that were adopted, and we're collecting and setting up the data collection now. The standards of timely disposition in Oregon Circuit Courts, we've had those in place since 92 when the Judicial Conference adopted disposition guidelines for different types of cases. Tomorrow we'll talk about the stats and how those are looking. Basically, we've lost some ground. We are good compared to other states, but good compared to other states is not necessarily good for Oregon. And when you see the types of cases they're in, I think we'll have a discussion about what's driving those pending caseloads, why they're getting bigger. And caseload monitoring is something we continue to do. On page 28 and 29, the partnership issue, we do have a lot of partners in various aspects, and even more so in the last two biennium, given both the move into family and drug courts, which have some natural partners at a lot of levels, but also in technology. We work very closely with DAS and the various work groups and the governor's IT roundtable. And as we get into those particular topics, we'll talk a little bit more about the partnerships, but we did give you some examples on these two pages of some of the major partnerships. 3031, you're going to get probably a lot of information from us and then through the Advancing E-Government on our information and technology systems. We're in front of Advancing E-Government next Monday in the afternoon, so I think that coincides with your time frames, but we are going to present an overview of our technology systems for you on Thursday. The next several pages respond to the questions that were asked in the outline overview on technology. I think in interest of our time, because we are going to come back to technology, I will not read off what each question was. And that goes through page 39. I want to mention very briefly on pages 40 and 41 two things. Affirmative action reports, you should have received with your budget document the Judicial Department's affirmative action plan. We are not, as a judicial branch, required by law to do a plan. However, because we are very interested in diversity in our workforce, and especially people coming in, having our workforce reflect that population, we have always, I would say for the last decade, had a plan and worked on collecting those stats. And so we do report along with everyone else, every biennium, how we're doing. We've still got a ways to go, but we are very committed to that goal. The compensation plan changes, I'm just mentioning here, because we don't have another mechanism. The Chief Justice, by statute, is required to maintain a personnel plan that's in reasonable conformity with the executive branch and the rest of state government. We do try to keep current in that plan by watching actions that are taking place in other branches of government, and also through the legislative disbursement at eBoard funds for selectives and for cost of living increases. We try to keep our employees comparable. Page 41 lists kind of four areas where we had adjustments in our comp plan through this last biennium. We have more specifics to the committee wanted. What we've set up in the summer, because we didn't have a really good mechanism to do this, is a system of notification so that we send a memorandum of changes that we're contemplating to both DAS and to legislative fiscal before they're entered into the system, so that when the picks and all the timelines are done, and if there's any problems, there'll be a way to alert you. But otherwise, the Chief Justice doesn't have an independent reporting requirement on that. On pages 42, really to the end, are the budget notes and our response to them. We had numerous appearances through the biennium. We were probably 60 boards. How many are there? We only missed one or two, I know that. On a variety of things, we had some of our budget allocations were reserved to the eBoard in technology and the family and drug court, and we had to come forward with plans on how they were going to be used and have a way to monitor those. We also had a number of reprioritizations of expenditures, looking at how to improve technology and our response to it in the court system, and eliminating redundant functions. We had a number also dealing with some of our workload issues, especially in the criminal justice area, that we responded to. I did bring copies of the various reports that were the official reports that we had to prepare during the biennium. We were happy to note there's a bill in that lets you now do a fiscal impact on your budget reports. I don't know if it's going to pass, but we're trying to calculate what the fiscal impact is on preparing that. So we will talk about some of these budget notes as we get into those topic areas, because I think they will give you the sense of continuity of where have we been this biennium and what are we building on, either in current service level or in our policy package for that specific area. As an example, we received the 35 positions for family and drug court during this biennium as limited duration. We are asking for continuation. We'll share with you what they're doing in the courts, what it means if we don't have them. And then we have a component for this biennium, because part of our budget note was to come up with a plan to implement these programs statewide. So we came up with a three-biennium, six-year plan to phase them in statewide. So we'll be discussing that. So that kind of ends our overview packet. Be happy to, as we get, like I said, get into the detailed areas to reference our budget document or specific statistics that you would like to see on those. I thought while we had a chance today, it would be helpful to kind of start with the top of the judicial branch and speak briefly about the Supreme Court Court of Appeals Tax Court and one of the issues in the Chief's operating level budget, which is the Supreme Court building. I did provide as a handout a compilation of the appellate court statistics. They are just there more as reference of the last 9 or 10 years in the various courts. But I was going to have the judges speak briefly about what are the kind of the workload factors for them right now that you see in the budget, and ask them to speak about just a couple of the policy packages that went with them handling their work. You should have a one sheet that says agenda, but down at the bottom there's a square that shows the policy packages that we're going to talk about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll truncate this. You do have a document titled Appellate Courts and Tax Court Statistics. I'm always mindful of a story about the statistician that drowned in the river with an average depth of 2 feet. So I offer these only as illustrative and not necessarily. I believe them to be accurate, but what you draw from them There are a couple of things going on. There is a concern both within the court and outside the court, both in our productivity, which is in the Supreme Court, productivity, how many cases we decide, and timeliness, how long it takes to assign the cases. Our golden year was the 91 to 93, and we were able to have about 84% of our cases decided within 6 months from the time of argument, which is not the whole story. We had no cases carried over from 92 to 93 undecided, under advisement. We have not reached that high water mark. In fact, we've sagged substantially. We're now, I think, building back, but in part, we're helped by the fact that the legislature allowed us to hire 3 new staff attorneys last biennium, and for fiscal reasons, they didn't come online. 2 came on in July, 1 came on in September of last year, and they're working full bore. There's some dynamics that are operating here. Prior to 1969, the Supreme Court, the direct review of the Oregon Supreme Court from all sources. They just filed the filing fee and you went to the Supreme Court. They got into a triage situation. They're hemorrhaging. They brought up trial judges to be pro tems. And in 69, the legislature added a new court called the Court of Appeals, Intermediate Court, Appellate Court, and it started out with taking administrative and criminal, and then it went to 6 members, and then 1977 it went to 10 members, its current membership. Theoretically, they were going to take almost all cases, with some exceptions, called a direct review. The legislature has been adding to that direct review, and I was surprised to find out last year, I think 51% of our cases came to us without any discretion on our part. We didn't get to take it or not, it just came. And they're listed on page 1 of the stats, ballot titles, which are eating us alive. We do also, we're a collection agency. In 95, the legislature said, and not necessarily incorrectly, that if you don't pay your child support or your student loans, the issuing agency is required to suspend the license. Well, we do that for lawyers. So now we're in the collection agency business. The only problem with that, it takes time away from the real work of the court, which is ballot titles. 92 cases were appealed to us last election cycle, not necessarily year cycle, election cycle. And I've been working with others, with Senator Harper and Senator Beyer, to see if there are ways of maintaining a satisfactory initiative process without just breaking down the Attorney General's office of the Supreme Court. And you can see our workload there. Disciplinary cases, bar cases, mandamus, habeas corpus, death penalty, tax, and others are those. That, and also we have the others are such things as prison siting, energy siting, and a variety of others that come directly to us out of the agency or out of the Circuit Court. Then there are general types of petitions. The staff attorneys we hired, which I still think we're probably understaffed on the West Coast per judge for support staff, which is okay, but staff attorneys do lawyer work, seasoned lawyer work. Our hope is that these will be career type lawyers at least for a decade or so that will master the work of the court and be assistant to the individual 7 members of the court. Law clerks are usually entry-level, first-year students, first-year lawyers that come in, and I'll put a plug in there. We have one who's been with us 2 years and is leaving to go to a Portland firm. We'll hear more about this later, but her starting salary in August will be $30,000 more than I make. Salaries have changed in the legal world. But normally law clerks, they're very good. They're usually top of their class. Various law schools, and the petitions clerks that we're asking for, 2 of them do the petition work, and they're more entry level. We hope that they like what they do and will stay with us, but they come in at a lower salary level, and they're not anticipated to be there for a long-term career, as we hope the staff attorneys will be. And petitions, kind of the mother may I in the federal system, is U.S. Supreme Court, the real Supreme Court, it's called a petition for certiorari. We just call it for petitions for review, and displayed there are the kinds of things that in gross categories that we look at, what we take, what percentage of the cases we take, and how many we take. there has been a growth in that area as well. So I'll leave it at that. The two petitions clerks that we're asking for this time in this one sheet budget, we have one, excuse me, one petition clerk. We think the workload has gone from around 700 to 900 petitions, and it will free up the elbow clerk, as some people call it, the law clerk to the judge and the staff attorneys and the judges to focus on getting opinions out, getting more opinions out, and getting them out more timely. With that, I'll quit.
Judge Carson, I'm just curious on the one table that shows types of cases decided and where you talk about other petitions for review, at least the last, the 1999-2000 term jumps up from 21 to 127.
Please help me, okay. Representative Doyle, please.
Other.
So page three?
Page three, right.
Okay.
Other petitions for review.
Ah, okay.
The classification other, I guess, just I'm curious if that accounts for the jump, or, I mean, how is it that we're seeing, I guess, such a large increase?
Chair Hansen, Representative Doyle, when I presented these statistics to the court, the same questions were asked. I went to my law clerk, who does most of the stats for me, and she gave me the answer, and that sheet's back in my office. I'll have to get back to you on it. It's, as you can see, is something that went from the below 20 up to 127 and jumped from 5 to 10% to 34% this past time. I think I know the kinds of things, but rather than misstating it, let me get back to you and have the answer tomorrow, if that's all right, or later this afternoon.
This is Judge Jack Landau with the Court of Appeals. He's going to speak briefly about their workload in one of the policy packages for regular law clerks. And then we have one item that recommend be a potential emergency board item.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jack Landau. I'm a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals. I'm the designated hitter this morning. The chief judge of our court was called out of town, and so I'm here this morning to answer any questions that you have. What I propose to do is two things. One is just give you a very, very brief overview of the court and its work. I'm frequently told that we are the most anonymous court in our system, and I'd like to remedy that as much as I can in a few brief moments. Second, talk specifically to one of the policy package items dealing with what we've called Balfour cases. And the third, of course, to answer any questions that you might have. I said two, and that's three. It shows that there are three kinds of people in the world, I suppose, those who can count and those who can't. We are an intermediate court of appeals. If you look at an organization chart, we're sandwiched in between the agencies, boards, and commissions, and the trial courts and the Supreme Court. Our job is to decide whether any of those decision-making agencies and courts below us on the chart have made mistakes. We do that by reviewing briefs, hearing oral arguments, researching the case law, and making decisions. I recently actually sat down and tried to add up the number of briefs that I've read in the last 8 years that I've been on the court. It is a stack of briefs that's roughly 20 stories tall. We do a lot of reading. We write a lot of opinions. The workload is actually the hallmark of the Court of Appeals. We are frequently cited as the most busiest or the most productive and one of the busiest courts in the entire country. Our caseload, as you can see from the statistics, usually runs between 4 and 5,000 new filings per year. It's actually sloped off a little bit in just the last couple of years. I think the statistics show that we're about 3,900 new filings per year. give you some sense of perspective, in 1977, the membership of the court was increased to 10 because of the then crushing caseload of 2,500 cases. And we've been operating at the 4,000 to 5,000 level ever since with the same number of judges. Another of the most important hallmarks of the Oregon Court of Appeals is that we are a non-discretionary court. We don't get to decide which cases we will take. We have to take everything except death penalty cases, taxes, and, thank God, ballot titles. We hear everything from adoption to parental termination cases, criminal cases. Actually, criminal cases are about 45% of our caseload. Civil cases, which is about 10 or 11% of the caseload, workers' compensation, tort cases, contract cases, land use cases, you name it, we take it. About a third of those cases will be disposed of. I usually say they will die of natural causes. They're withdrawn or people just decide not to pursue them. But the other half to two-thirds, several thousand cases a year, we actually have to review. We sit as 10 judges, three panels of three, with the 10th judge, who is the chief judge, who is the administrator of a court. Of the 2,500 cases that are actually decided by the three member panels, we can decide those cases either by issuing written opinions or by affirming without opinion. We affirm without opinion roughly two-thirds of the cases, and we write approximately 500-600 opinions a year. Trust me, that's a lot of opinions a year. Particularly given the kind of schedule that we have. We hear oral argument in 15 or so cases once a week. I can tell you for every day of oral argument, it takes usually about 2 days to read the briefs in preparation, so that's 3 days a week. And then every other week we have opinion conference, and it takes about a day to prepare for the opinion conference. And what it leaves when you add up the days is we have about 3 days a month to think about cases and write opinions. What that generally means is the chief and others can attest is that we usually go home with big stacks of briefs in our hands, and as my wife will frequently complain, the briefs generally accompany us to vacations and other places. If you have no questions about the general snapshot of the court, I wanted to mention something about the policy package that we've denominated Balfour briefing. The problem is, or has to do with indigent defense cases, cases in which the defendants in criminal matters are constitutionally entitled to a lawyer, but can't afford it, and so they get a lawyer at state expense. And specifically, the problem arises, what happens when the lawyer decides that there's no appealable issue, that there's no non-frivolous issue to present to the courts? What the lawyers used to do is that they would simply send a letter to the court and say, there are no appealable issues, and I would like to withdraw because I have an ethical obligation, the lawyer says, not to pursue frivolous issues in front of the court. The problem is that the United States Supreme Court said you can't do that. You can't just withdraw and leave your client high and dry. Well, what the Oregon Supreme Court said is, to remedy that, you should file a brief with the court that says there are no appealable issues, but then not withdraw. Stay there to provide advice to the client as he or she decides to pursue whatever non-meritorious claims there may be. That's been the state of affairs for about 11 years since State versus Balfour was decided, when the Oregon Supreme Court said this is the way that you can do it. We get about 650 Balfour cases a year, by the way. That's about 1,300 cases per biennium. Last year, the federal district court in Oregon decided that our Balfour procedures are unconstitutional. What the court said was, as it reads the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, we, as the appellate courts, cannot simply take the word of the lawyers when they tell us that there are no appealable issues. What the court is requiring us to do is to independently review the briefs, the transcripts, and other materials in each of these Balfour cases, independently assess whether there is any non-frivolous issue. and then require briefing on any of such issues. In effect, what the court's requiring us to do is to look over the shoulder of the lawyer, do the lawyering work, and decide whether there's something else that the defendant should be presenting to the courts. Obviously, this presents a new and unexpected work problem for us. As I said, it's about 1,300 new cases per biennium. We are not proposing that we add any judges to remedy that problem. We are proposing that we add several staff attorneys and some support staff. We think that with some professional staff and some supervision by the judges, we could probably handle that. But I wanted to let you know that is in our package so that you could see that on the horizon. With that, I'll close. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to ask Judge Landau to talk about his outreach program. The Supreme Court goes to each of the three law schools annually, and then a couple of either colleges or high schools to have oral argument. But the Court of Appeals is blown by us, and they go out, and it's been wonderfully well received by the bench, the bar, and the communities. And Judge Landau, I know you're instrumental in making that happen.
Well, I mentioned, thank you, Chief Justice. I mentioned that we are a very anonymous court, and one of the things that we've been trying to do to remedy that is to get out into the community at every opportunity. It also seemed to us that it would be particularly helpful if we didn't just get out into the community, but if we targeted kids in particular. It seems to us especially important that we help kids understand basic civics, understand how their government works, and if at all possible, see how it works. It's not possible for kids in Enterprise or Medford or Rome to come to Salem and see the Court of Appeals, so we decided we would go there. The response has really been overwhelming. We have a long list of schools that would like us to come. Generally what we do is each month one of the three panels will visit a high school around the state. We will hold argument, usually in the school auditorium. We try to tailor the cases. We select the cases out of that month's worth of cases so that the kinds of cases the students readily can understand. The lawyers have been extraordinarily cooperative. The schools will then hold assemblies where there will be anywhere from 300 to 1,000 students in attendance watching the oral arguments. After each oral argument, we will take questions from the audience about the way that the court operates. Obviously, we don't talk about the specifics of the cases. I usually dish those questions off to the lawyers. And then we will go visit individual civics or American government classes and answer questions. A couple of weeks ago, we actually did our first middle school. We had an extraordinarily successful full day with Sunrise Middle School in Clackamas. The kids were just remarkable in both their respect for the court and the proceedings and the thoughtfulness of their questions. I have a seventh grader. I was still surprised at just really how attentive the kids were.
Senator Trill?
I was just going to say that one of the teams came to Oregon State a couple of years ago, and I had the pleasure of going and seeing that a little bit and joining them for lunch, and I know how much they appreciated that. It was well done.
Chair, I'll report that, that both the Supreme Court in the last two or three years and the Court of Appeals have been to Philomath High School. So it's in your district.
That's in my district, absolutely. That's great. Thank you. That's wonderful.
We have been to as far east as Enterprise and LeGrand, as far south as Ashland and Medford. We've been to the coast a couple times. We're going to Beaverton next month. We really enjoy it.
Really great.
The other thing that I neglected to mention,
Representative Knope, did you?
I'm sorry.
On your page 4, Court of Appeals Comparative Statistics, you have several categories there, and all of them I had a pretty good idea of what might be the cases that you'd be looking at, except for traffic. Please tell me that people aren't appealing their traffic tickets to the Court of Appeals. I noticed that since the early 90s, it's essentially doubled. And it took a considerable jump from 99 to, let's see, it looks like from 99 to 2000. What kind of cases would those represent?
There'd be a lot of, Mr. Chair, Representative Knope, there'd be a lot of DUI driving under the influence cases in that category.
Okay.
I'm not sure what accounts for a more than twofold increase over the last 10 years, but I do know there's been a substantial increase in those kinds of cases.
Okay.
There was one other thing that Kingsley asked me to mention that I wanted to let you know of, particularly because of the legislature's actions on our budget last year. We have a settlement conference program. As I mentioned, we were always looking for ways to streamline, to be more productive. What we have is a small group of professional staff supervising a larger group of lawyers whom the staff train to mediate cases while they're pending before the Court of Appeals. And the legislature recently funded the director on a full-time basis, which has really helped the program enormously. We have to date settled 576 cases. That's as many cases as I wrote in 6 years, as many opinions. So I can tell you that we really appreciate the work of the staff and of the lawyers. It has become a model for a number of states around the country who have come to visit us and say, how do you do this? Nobody thought 10 years ago that settlement conferences would work on appeal. The story was, well, people only appeal cases they think are meritorious, and they're pretty much locked into their positions, and they're not likely to settle. And what we've found is that that's not true, and that of those cases that are screened into the program, we settle approximately 56% of them. So we're very proud of the work of the settlement program. I wanted to thank you for the support in that regard.
Chief Justice, the Supreme Court has been working on an appellate settlement program, right, as well,
based We've
on
copied
its
the
success.
Court of Appeals. To a much lesser degree, I think we had three cases and one settled. It's understandable, if I may, Mr. Chair, that by the time it gets to the process, they're pretty well dug in, and I think because of the high success in the Court of Appeals, once we allow review in a case, the likelihood of the party that might win settling is somewhat remote, but we've tried it in one bar disciplinary case which failed. We tried it in a very complicated adoption custody battle that originally failed, but ultimately was resolved to a very good success. And then we had another one that was resolved. So we like the program too, we just don't avail ourselves.
We attempt with ballot titles.
Well, as a matter of fact, with the Rules Committee in the Senate, we've talked about we're desperate, and they're not, I am, and I've pretty well examined almost everything we could think of, and we did have that discussion.
Senator Trill.
As the caseload seems to do nothing but grow into the future, do you see the necessity down the road, not this time, but down the road, to add more judges, or will you do what I think I see you doing now, and that's keeping the core about the same and just trying to get more experienced and legal staff that can help the judges do those decisions better and quicker?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, eventually the caseload will grow to the breaking point, I have no doubt. If population statistics continue their trends as Oregon grows, as the number of cases grows, we will reach a point where we just can't get any more cases out without more judges. We don't think we're there yet, and we're content to try to push and squeeze as much as we can with existing judges and see if we can't maximize our productivity through staff. I really don't know when that breaking point is going to be, but I think it's still a bit off in the distance.
What percentage of the cases relate to drug and alcohol?
I don't have any hard numbers. I could just give you my rough sense of it, and it's a lot. Of the criminal cases, I would be surprised if it's fewer than half the cases are related to drugs and alcohol. It's just astonishing.
Do you think it makes sense as a policy for the state to review its laws regarding drug and alcohol to see if they really meet the needs for the future?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, certainly I think that's something that the legislature should always be looking at. I don't, as I sit here, have any suggestions for you in that regard, but given the overwhelming impact of drugs and alcohol on the criminal case docket, I think it's something we need to look at real carefully.
One final question. On your the four appeal law clerks for the Balfour proceedings, when did the decision come down, and how have you been dealing with it up until now?
Well, Mr. Chair, the actual posture of this case is kind of interesting. The decision was first made by a magistrate in January of last year. That decision held that our Balfour procedure was unconstitutional. It's in the context of a habeas corpus case in federal court. The state representing the superintendent appealed that to an Article III district judge. The district judge said that he agreed that our procedure was unconstitutional, but threw the case out on a technicality, said that the petitioner in that case had not preserved the issue, and so it wasn't appropriately before the court. So technically, we have no decision requiring us to do this right now. We're told that the petitioner will be appealing this to the Ninth Circuit. So what we have is two decisions from the federal courts clearly stating that what we're doing is unconstitutional, but we have no judgment yet requiring us to do it. So we haven't started doing it yet, but the handwriting pretty clearly seems to be on the wall.
Before we move on, Mr. Chair, if I may, to answer in part, Representative Doyle and others might be interested. By powers of deduction, and I credit myself with more intellect than I think I have, if you look at the Court of Appeals comparative statistics, you'll find the following categories that are subject to petition to our court that aren't listed, and they would probably fall in the category. I'll get a definitive answer. But adoption, domestic relations, juvenile, parental termination, LUBA, parole review, and the blip, I would suggest, that we had last year was largely of what we call the Hamill case, which had to do with review of the corrections or the prisons, habeas corpus, and record review there, and also mental commitments. I think those are the others, but I'll get back to you, Mr. Chair, with a more definitive answer. But do you want to move on?
Well, but just before we do, both judges mentioned the outreach programs of going out into the community. There is another program that will probably be starting this year that kind of came to us, right. OPAN.
OPAN, the court has given permission, and I know the legislature has, to, I don't know why anybody would watch it, frankly, but it's they're going to do gavel-to-gavel, both of the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court on the Oregon Public Affairs Network. They're supposed to be up doing your committee meetings gavel-to-gavel. It's kind of like C-SPAN. It's a good project, and we're excited about it. I did find myself watching a Salem City Council meeting one time, and I thought, I have no life. and it was a rerun. It wasn't the actual. I don't do that. I read now. But it is out there, and we're pleased because it will provide greater access both to our court and the court.
People to know what courts are doing, and,
right.
And especially at the appellate level, because you mentioned it's not always known. But
sometimes it's difficult to tell if those are reruns.
They sound a lot.
I would think it would be a selective clientele that would want to watch it. People who are training for the legal profession and others to see how it works. And then those who somehow or other need to deal with the courts might watch. I don't think it'll have a great general population audience.
Sure, Senator Tro, our last big crowd, I think, was when Amon and Sheila was in the audience, and our gate has gone down substantially since then. I do think there is a need, and we're looking into connecting it with our website so that lawyers can identify similar cases that they might have either in the appellate system or in trial, and by going onto the net, they can find out when those are going to be argued and broadcast and listen live to the oral argument. And they will, as a matter of fact, be be digital, and they'll be recorded digitally, and they will be archivable, and so be available not only for our records, but others as well.
That's good.
It's a good program.
Yeah.
Okay. The next court is the tax court, and the presiding tax magistrate, Scott Sedaris, is here, I believe, with Paul Picarell, who's the administrator for the tax court and tax magistrates. September of 1997, when the legislature made effective the move of the, it was a hearings unit in the Department of Revenue, which became the tax magistrates division. So with that, Andre, I'll let you give a little history and the stats, but we are not asking for a policy package in this area, but we want you to know that current service level is very important to maintaining where they are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll just take a little time to talk to you about what I regard as the jewel in the crown of Oregon's judicial system, the Oregon Tax Court. I'm Scott Sedaris, the presiding magistrate, and senators and representatives now at what could be the midpoint of the session. You have some 200 tax measures before you. Some of those will become law and woven into the comprehensive code that reaches into every household and business in the state of Oregon, Oregon's revenue laws. The Oregon Tax Court exists for the purpose of maintaining that system in a fair, equitable standard that expresses the justice that people expect from their tax system. Oregon is a leader in its tax court. In 1961, Oregon became the first state to say, this matter is so important and so specialized, we must have a tax court to decide it. Another step forward was taken in 1995 when this body said, we will establish a magistrate's division in the tax court to make sure that Oregon taxpayers receive the degree of justice that they expect. The tax court has been a leader in the implementation of technology and court procedures, and also has been the first state to apply on an extensive basis appropriate dispute resolution, a non-judicial tool, to the resolution of tax disputes. Now, in so far as what our statistics show, since 1995, we have had on the order, no, I will revise that. Since 1997, we've had on the order 6,500 appeals filed in the tax court. These are appeals that come to the court from the decisions of the counties in a property tax matter, from the decisions of the Department of Revenue in a program administered by that agency, and they come first to the magistrate division. Our time for closing out one of those appeals is on the order of 4 months. Those litigants who are dissatisfied with the decision of a magistrate have the opportunity to appeal to the regular division of the tax court. There, the tax court judge, we have one judge, hears their appeal. That judge is heard on the order of 120 appeals of these 6,500 that have come into the court. The judge has chosen to reverse the magistrate some 17 times, and so we are doing a very responsible job of deciding Oregon tax questions.
Does the magistrate always screen the cases before they get to the judge? Does the judge have any, what we call, original jurisdiction on anything?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, the judge does have a very limited original jurisdiction, most particularly as to matters under Measure 5 and Measure 50 that go to a tax or fee question. However, thankfully, we've had remarkably few of those appeals. Since 1997, I think we've had in the order of half a dozen. Now, from the judge, there's an opportunity to appeal his decision to the Supreme Court. The review at the Supreme Court level is limited. It's not on the order of a conventional case. It proceeds to the Supreme Court from the Court of Appeals. The bottom line is that I can present to you, in all honesty, we're doing a very responsible, effective job, and that is extremely important because government, as you well know, runs on the revenue it raises. And the alacrity and enthusiasm with which taxpayers open their checkbooks often depends on how fair they see the system as being, and it is our purpose to make sure that we do have a fair system of imposing and collecting tax in Oregon. We're not asking you for any more money. Our budget is the same as last year, and I think I can very truthfully present to you that we're doing a responsible job with the money, and stand open and available, of course, for any questions you might have.
Yeah. Our last item for today's agenda is our Supreme Court building certificate of participation. Because there is a line item for debt service of $193,000 in our budget request and as part of what we call the Chief Justice's current operating level, because if the COPs are issued, we will have that debt service. That's Scott Crampton, who's the Appellate Court Services Director, who worked with DAS and with the various groups on the COP process, just to give you a little more information about what it entails. Take just a few minutes.
Good morning. For your record, I'm Scott Crampton, the Appellate Court Services Director of the Judicial Department. I'm going to take just a couple minutes to talk about a unique but important package that we have under the capital budgeting category to transition the Supreme Court building. The Supreme Court building is one of the oldest facilities on the Capitol Mall. It was built in 1914 and has been placed on the historic register. The building is titled to the Judicial Department, and unlike most of the buildings in the Capitol Mall area, it is not owned or managed by the Department of Administrative Services. Although the building has been painstakingly maintained and fulfilled its role as the home of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Supreme Court Library, and the Supreme Court Room, we now face a challenge to adapt the Supreme Court building into a specialized modern research center to be known as the State of Oregon Law Library, if enabling legislation is passed. This will require a major construction project which will adapt the existing infrastructure to support research activities which, to a large degree, utilize technology. The proposed construction project will redesign the work areas within the library on the second floor, renovate the electrical and data processing systems, and soundproof the windows on the 12th and State Street sides of the building. Presently, the Supreme Court building is simply not equipped to handle high-tech oriented environment. The building's electrical system is outdated and cannot support expansion of electrical and data systems. For example, there are no electrical outlets adjacent to the library workstations where patrons can use laptop or dedicated personal computers. There's one personal computer with internet access available for public use. There are no individual work carrels where patrons can conduct legal research in private. And the facility has single pane windows which cannot tolerate external noise from trained and vehicle traffic to the point where normal conversations inside the building must pause until the external noise abates. This is the scope of what we're talking about doing. In the present biennia, the Supreme Court building has merely conducted deferred maintenance projects on an ad hoc basis using individual general fund appropriations. However, we're now at a point where we required an integrated approach in the form of this major construction project. In the executive branch, the Department of Administrative Services funds its capital budget projects through proceeds derived from the uniform rent payments paid by its tenants. The Judicial Department, however, has never received funding for rent payments for the Supreme Court space and therefore doesn't have a fiscal reserve to draw upon. So the assumption of this proposed construction project would require a debt service appropriation, which could be viewed as a parallel to the uniform rent funding that executive agencies receive each biennium.
Does Cochran's budget have anything?
In summary, we're looking at taking this facility from the last century into the next by reconstructing the infrastructure in it, which will enable us to upgrade the electrical and the power and the lighting and so forth so that it can be used for its new purpose, which is as a comprehensive legal research center for all state agencies and citizens. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
I have two. Does any of this apply to seismic upgrades also?
Seismic upgrades are not contained in this particular package, although our long-term vision would be that this would be a series of capital budget projects that would address all the areas that need to be maintained, including structural, such as that. This is really the first and the most immediate need that we have to address the electrical and systems in the building.
The other question, does any of this relate to energy conservation? And I think there are some other funding sources available for...
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, no, this doesn't address energy conservation per se. We did just complete a new heating system as a result of the decommissioning of the heat plant. The window portion of it could be viewed as a energy conservation component.
As Scott mentioned, last biennium, the Supreme Court building had an appropriation to replace the boiler because of the decommissioning, and that'll be one of the monies that'll be have cycled out of our CSL. And as the chief is a witness on the issues with the windows, how many trains go by a day, did you
22.
Say? 22 a day.
Whistles blaring.
Yeah. At what time?
And we
we
add that into the delay on deliberations of everything stuff. That's right. Trains stopping. But we very much appreciate opportunity to give you an overview today, and tomorrow we'll give you an overview of the workload factors and then talk about judicial resources and anything else that you would like us to cover.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chairman. One issue I want to look at over the coming days, and I raise this as a non-attorney, and if I'm stirring up a hornet's nest, I hope folks will tell me this. I'd like to see a breakdown of the indigent defense versus the DAs and how that funding has worked and the balance between the two. I represent 8 counties with 8 different county commissions, and that's an issue that's been raised on both sides. And it's very difficult for a non-attorney to weigh the merits of the funding. So if over the coming days I can get a summary of that. And then second, and I don't know if any of the other members would be interested in this. I've never been to the Supreme Court, and I'd be very interested in having a tour in the coming days just to see what the building looks like. And
we give tours.
Yeah, sure. Well, last session I recall us going up and for lunch.
Right.
Maybe it was 2 sessions ago.
We do it biannually with the Judiciary Committees. And maybe we ought to do the same stuff. You're more important to us right now.
It was actually a lot of fun.
Yeah. Is that in the current service level?
We'll find it.
Well, actually, we're a lot smaller than the Judiciary Committee, so it'd save you a buck or two.
Which we would appreciate.
Mr. Chair, following up on Representative Smith's request, if we could get... per capita costs as it relates to indigent defense and how we compare with the rest of the nation. I know we've received that in terms of judicial compensation and how we compare with other states, but that would be helpful for us to have, too, in terms of indigent defense. And the DA funding would probably come from somewhere else, but I know that indigent defense is in your budget, so that would be helpful.
Any additional questions?
Mr. Chair, at some point we're going to have a review of the additional judges that are needed and so forth. That's going to happen in the course of...
Chair Hansen, Senator Trove, yes, tomorrow we'll cover the committee recommendations in the second part. And in interest of your time, I've not had particular judges from the individual districts plan in as a presentation, but more the overview, but we'd be happy to set up a day to do that, if that's something, if you want to hear from each of those after you hear the overall, if you want more specific information. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, at this point, we will adjourn, and I think the record should note that in the absence of Chair Miller, we adjourned 15 minutes early.